You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show.
I have a message! A message from the people of Kentucky. A message that is loud and clear and does not mince words. We've come to take our government back.
Republican Senator Rand Paul enters the US presidential fray. But can a true libertarian ever make it to the White House? We'll find out. Then it's just days away before Barack Obama and Raul Castro head to Panama for the summit of the Americas. But will Cuba be removed from a US list of terrorism sponsoring countries before then? And later in the show, Greece has asked Germany for nearly 280 billion euros in reparations for the latter's wartime Nazi occupation. But do reparations ever address real grievances or heal wounds? We'll have a debate here in the studio. All those stories and more coming up right now on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And welcome to Midori House. And my guests today are regular Monocle contributors Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Latin American expert and senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University, and Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London. Welcome both to the programme, and I hope you had a nice Easter too. Well, let's begin the show over in the US, where Republican Senator Rand Paul officially launched his presidential campaign today. Rand, along with his equally famous father Ron, might differ from the rest of the inevitable GOP pack in that he's a committed libertarian. It's been tricky for serious libertarians to develop a broad appeal in the US. The ideology generally favours fiscally conservative, socially liberal moves with a non-interventionist foreign policy attached to it. Yet it seems that Paul is already considered among the top-tier candidates. Kathleen, can a true libertarian ever win through? And I think we should actually define what a true libertarianism in the version of in America is not what you'd think of here in Europe, I think.
No, I think that ought to have been your job. essentially, a libertarian believes that the duty and the responsibilities of government should be as little as possible, that a man or a woman should do for herself and himself what can be done without governmental help. Now, as a basis, this is not perhaps terribly useful for a modern government. I mean, Rand Paul has a problem, doesn't he? I mean, on one, he has several different constituencies. The constituency of the Tea Party, very libertarian, as you say, no government, low taxes, get off my back sort of thing, but in the nicest possible way. He's not a nasty libertarian. He's a very respectable libertarian. But also, he has other ideas, especially in terms of foreign policy, that do not accord necessarily with the Republican libertarians. And so he has a choice. He can try to straddle two or three different constituencies and hope to bring them together, or as more likely is going to happen, he's going to fall right between them, between those who want more intervention abroad, which he doesn't, and those who want very little intervention at home.
Now, Oscar, what we're talking about there is the fact that, you know, he believes, you know, that some troops abroad might be needed. He's been, you know, he hasn't been completely condemning of the president on everything that happened in Iraq. Now, that won't appeal to his core base, will it? Because they're defiant that, you know, the US should really have no remit outside the country.
That's absolutely the case. In fact, he has already moved towards the more mainstream Republican view on issues such as Iran and or Israel. What he thought, you know, as early as 2011 seems to be very different from what he's saying nowadays. That's a huge problem, but it indicates that the real question in the Republican primaries, who can sway the Tea Party vote towards him? And I'm afraid if that is the case, then probably Ted Cruz or even someone like Jeb Bush may have much more of a chance.
Kathy?
Well, there's, I mean, one thing that's interesting there is that in primaries in the United States, as we all know, you have to make sure you get your core voters. On the other hand, getting your core voters in a constituency, an electorate that is so riven in with a lot of deep crevices between them, means that you're going to fall and not get the others. Paul actually, because he does appeal to more than one, might actually do rather better than others in that, because you can get the nomination, but you can't win the ball game, as Mitt Romney found out. And it seems to me that because Rand Paul doesn't get people's dander up in the way that people like Cruz does, for example, actually is a more humanizing candidate than many one might actually think about. So I started thinking about this a few minutes ago. Did he have a chance? But the more I think about it, perhaps he's one of nature's natural vice presidents.
Absolutely. I mean, it would be very interesting to see a debate between him and Hillary. That, you know, it would be an interesting contest. But again, I can't see the Republican Party.
But listen, yeah, he dresses as part. He looks like an older Mark Zuckerberg, actually, when you look at him. Yes. That's what he looks like. And we mustn't, of course, confuse liberal with libertarian. But you know, the problem for the Republican Party in the past has been its ability to kind of pull in younger voters, for example, and to appeal to, you know, an urban demographic as well. Now, he is libertarian, but he's certainly opposed to gay marriage. He's opposed to abortion. He's opposed to legalizing the use of drugs. Many of the issues that have been taken up as libertarian by other parts of, you know, the political parties in the US. Kathy, do you think that's a problem? You know, that yes, he can appeal to this core, often southern, often rural voter, but he just can't quite get in. You can't see him winning through in a New York or a Los Angeles or a San Francisco.
That's the problem in many respects. If you look at the United States, is it a big place? It's London to Damascus. And people look at the bigness and think, gosh, Nebraska's going that way and Kansas going that way, forgetting there's not a lot of people comparatively speaking there. I mean, the anti-abortion, for example, and the anti-gay marriage, those are now those are majority opinions in the United States. Now, if Paul uses as his some of his main positions to mobilize his part of the electorate, it won't work once he actually gets into an election. The thing is, of course, is there's an awful lot of issues. And ideally for him, once if he did get the nomination, those would pale before what you do about Iran or what you do about gun laws or what you do about the budget. So the sorts of things he's going for now, they are not majority opinions. So he's going to have to hope, perhaps, that they become less important.
Well, a libertarian-inspired, non-interventionist American foreign policy might be what the Castro brothers dream of down in Cuba. Today, Barack Obama said he'll act quickly once the State Department gives a recommendation on whether to take Cuba off its list of terrorism-sponsoring nations. The State Review was ordered immediately after the December 17th diplomatic breakthrough between Washington and Havana. Well, there's been a bit of ticking clock since then, and we'll talk about that just in a moment. Obama will come face to face with Raul Castro at the summit of the Americas in Panama, however, on Friday. Let's start with you, Oscar. You know, we've seen a slight breakthrough. Do we feel that there's an inevitability now to a warming of ties between the two countries?
Well, there is nothing inevitable when it comes to U.S.-Latin America relations. The only one thing that is inevitable is that we will never have a non-interventionist U.S. president. let's say it how it is. And that's the problem, because right now there is a lot of suspicion among mainly progressive governments in Latin America, not just Venezuela, but also Brazil, the U.S. is, back at its old business and playing behind the scenes with opposition protests in the streets and so on, and even the usual old coup d'etat idea might be rearing its ugly head back again. So it's going to be a very tense meeting. What would make it less tense would be a sort of masterstroke by Barack Obama if he takes Cuba off the list. I I wouldn't vet. I'm not sure that's going to happen so soon. It is a very contentious issue outside of the Oval Office. I'm sure pretty much, whether it's the Republican candidates or the Democrats, you won't have many voices going for it. Having said that, there is a sense of history here, and there is a momentum. So they might take the chance. If so, we will see history in the making.
Kathleen, it's interesting that we see some kind of warming of these relations potentially between Havana and Washington. But in the meantime, the Brazilians are certainly suspicious of what's going on in Washington. The Venezuelans are naturally rather upset what's going on. They feel that that their government is being undermined and that the opposition are being backed. Some might say, well, quite rightly so. But do you feel that America is playing a rather complicated hand in Latin America?
Well, it's not Latin America. It's an awful lot of individual countries, isn't it? It has to be a complicated hand. I suspect that under Obama, there's probably less difficult things going on or deniable things going on than there might have been with some other presidents, of which we could all name, in fact. I think that Obama is less likely to at least under his to be agreeing to nasty sorts of things. I mean, the problem is as well, the U.S. is very useful for Latin American governments. It's someone who can always be blamed if things are going wrong. Now, this is not to say that the Americans aren't helping to make things go wrong, but I suspect not as often as might be useful. There's no need to try to get rid of Maduro, for example. If you stand up on top and look down, I mean, he's doing a perfectly good job himself. Don't need the Americans. So I think it's a good chance with Obama. I think he's the sort of president who would like to make things rather better. He's less complicated than someone like Kennedy, who said he wanted it, but then didn't want what would have to be done to do it. So I hope, and Oscar will know, have more ideas about this than I do. I know that the opportunity can be used on Friday and Saturday to actually move things ahead even a little bit can only be good for the rest of us.
Absolutely. It can only be good. And again, certain things have changed. Latin America is showing much more unity than it has in the past. We're not talking just a bunch of individual diverse countries, but in fact, as shown by the fact that all of them, including those who have been staunch U.S. allies, such as Colombia, condemned the declaration of emergency that painted Venezuela as a threat for the national security of the U.S. And that plus the fact that there have been many stills, many suspicions in other countries, working against this historical opportunity.
Oscar, do you feel that some of those governments feel a little bit more cautious or nervous even at the moment? Let's look at Brazil. The economy is going into recession. Venezuela, the economy is a disaster. That's when oppositions rise up. Is that why they're also nervous? They realize, the U.S. Probably does support the opposition in Venezuela. The U.S. probably would like to see greater transparency and less corruption in Brazil. There is a bit of a tension there, and perhaps there rightfully should be so.
You're absolutely right in pointing out that there are economic problems. And in fact, what could be best for the entire hemisphere than better economic relations between the U.S. and Latin America would be good for both the U.S. and Latin American countries. But one must not over-exaggerate the importance of opposition protests in Latin American countries. They are highly localized in the cases of Venezuela and Brazil, much more so than our mainstream media would let us to believe. That's part of the problem. And because of that, these countries do feel, and these progressive governments do feel, that they must show their strength in the conference, and I'm certain we'll see that.
Well, we're going to take a very short break now. Kathleen and Oscar will be here when we return. Up next, we'll ask if reparations ever work. We'll find out which strongman enjoys America's heavy-handed policing record, and then which Latin American country does Jeb Bush come from?
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
The perfect way to start the day in Europe is with Monocle's morning news programme, The Globalist. Join Monocle 24's editors, presenters and guests as they set the agenda in international news and business. The show's weekly series unpacks an idea over the course of a week, hearing from the creative thinkers and dynamic characters shaping the sector. The Globalist delves deeper to bring you the full story. Every day, the show's guest newspaper reviewer trains a critical eye and plenty of expertise and wit on the best periodicals from Australia to Japan and India to Turkey. The Globalist also features The Monologue, a daily column in which Monocle's editors express forthright opinion and a unique editorial voice. The Globalist premieres every weekday at the new time of 1500 hours in Tokyo, 9 a.m. in Istanbul and 7 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Kathleen Burke from University College London and Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University. Let's turn now to Athens, where the government there has just announced a number for the amount of war reparations it would like paid to it by Germany, 279 billion euros or 204 billion pounds. Kathleen, it's a long time after the event. The Germans say that they did pay money, that this issue is long ago settled, and they certainly don't wish to reopen it. And there's some belief that, you know, the Greeks are certainly doing this to kind of rankle and slightly poke at the Germans in response to what's going on in their economy. But this very notion of paying reparations, do you feel, you know, for in Greece's example or in any country's example, paying reparations can make good for the bad that was done?
Well, reparations in Germany have a bad odor, of course. After the First World War, they were supposed to pay well over 100 billion gold marks as reparations to France and so forth. They didn't pay most of them because Hitler said no. And of course, after the end of the Second World War, they were forgiven. The Germans were forgiven, so they didn't have to pay them. What the Germans did do after the Second World War, of course, was to pay reparations to Israel, a huge amount. They paid 190 million in reparations to Greece in 1990, before the current, before the Germany was unified. And reparations, there are a couple of things, aren't they? They're supposed to repair, money to repair whatever has been damaged, but they're also a punishment. And I suspect the Germans feel they've been punished enough, thank you very much. This is unfortunate. It's too bad the Greeks didn't come up with this a bit earlier.
Oscar, do you feel that there should be a time limit on these things? The strange thing is that the people being asked to pay are now often of a generation that certainly had nothing to do with the war or the crimes committed, and their political beliefs and all they've done in their lives may have been in absolute opposition to what the Nazis, for example, stood for. Do you feel it's a time really for Greece to put this behind and move on?
That's the usual view, and there is a kernel of truth to that view. But it may be contended. Reparations have a bad name because they're more often than not represented under a loss-based model, which makes raises all sorts of impossible questions. Where do we begin? Counterfactuals such as what if Greece had never been intervened by the Germans and so on, which can never be re-answered. But that's not the only model that there is. A lawyer might tell you that there is an alternative model. You might use a gain-based based, gains-based model in which those who hold some possession are, can be constructed as constructive trustees. And in that model, you can come up with funds and endowments in order to make up for historical wrongs. And then the issue of the statute of limitations is non-important, because the issue of limitations only comes up if we assume that historical wrongs compound interest infinitely. But if under the other model we say, well, they vary historically, then it turns out that in certain moments of political volatility, when risks are higher, that's when you should ask for reparations. And that's exactly what the Greeks are doing. It's a very interesting strategy. I'll tell you why.
But it's also interesting for, you know, Latin America. You know, Latin America, they could ask the Spanish for money. You know, the Caribbean nations could ask, say, you know, our nations were destroyed by the slave trade.
They sued, in fact, almost a dozen of them just sued the British government a year ago. And you might remember for that very reason. There is a case, and in fact, one can write a story you mentioned of these things. You mentioned Latin America, and there is a very interesting resonance between what the Greeks are doing now and what Salvador Allende did in the 1970s in Chile, when he nationalized the copper industries. They came up with this doctrine, the excess profits doctrine, and that's very much what the Greeks are doing now. What they are doing, this is part of a wider strategy to show what is happening in Greece as a humanitarian crisis, a man-made one, which makes that the austerity measures can be seen as at least morally illegitimate. And if you connect them with the liability issue, they may be some legal repercussions. All you have to do is to set up a sort of Russell-like tribunal. And if they do that, you may have something like the Bandung Conference too, but in Europe. That would be interesting.
Good. Well, we're going to... there's lots to think about there. We're going to move on now to Myanmar, or Burma, which is apparently looking to the US for the justification of its heavy-handed policing. After police assaulted unarmed student protesters there, the Minister of Information cited Occupy Wall Street and the riots in Ferguson, Missouri, saying that nobody spoke of US democracy having backtracked. Kathleen, do you feel that, it is interesting. Even today, we had a major case of, you know, a gentleman being let off of death row. You know, it turned out he was innocent. He'd been there for years and years. You know, the US is always criticizing other nations with their judiciary system and the failures of it. But is it very difficult for the US to challenge other countries about their policing, about how they treat its citizens, when there are these huge civil rights cases going on in its own country?
One should not underestimate American self-righteousness. And also, on the other hand, Americans have very high ideals, which they theoretically try to live up to. And they like to look out in other countries and think they ought to be living up to them. Obviously, I mean, you need only look at what's happening in the States and elsewhere, and you think, why do they have the nerve to complain when, as you say, Ferguson and Myanmar? On the other hand, it's not very often that the U.S. is held up as a model of how not to treat in general terms, if you see what I mean. I'm not being very clear. What I mean is that this is such a ridiculous comparison in American terms that it's going to have no effect whatsoever, I don't think. This is something being a rock thrown into the pond by Myanmar. It's not going to do anything at all. I'm not quite sure why they bothered.
But Oscar, do you feel that, you know, these cases do undermine some, you know, moral authority? You know, that when you speak out against injustices in other countries, if you're doing so from the US, you know, it is just very likely that people are going to say, well, hold on, you know, we're watching on our television screens, we're reading, when we pick up the newspaper, stories emanating from the US, which seem to underline the fact that, you know, civil rights there are a huge issue.
I've lost my faith in that kind of criticism. It is a bit like what happens with Coke. I mean, we all know that it doesn't make us any less thirsty, and yet we keep drinking it. So to speak of...
I'm glad you're talking about the drink. I was getting a bit worried.
Being a Colombian, I should. You know, it is this idea that the U.S. is contradicts itself. Well, of course, but that's not gonna have any effect, neither moral nor political. I can think of at least three or four better reasons why American towns and cities shouldn't be using military grade weapons to curb protests.
But Kathleen, just before we quickly move on from this, do you feel that anybody listens now when you criticize each other's countries? You know, I wonder, you know, does it really matter? You know,
Probably not.
I think that everybody's got these kind of filters now that, you know, who is America to criticize us, for example?
I think you listen to it when it accords with what you believe yourself, and you laugh at it when it doesn't.
That's it, yeah.
Well, finally, we're going to move on to a story about Jeb Bush, who is apparently Hispanic. The former Florida governor accidentally, well, it seems, labelled himself as Hispanic on his 2009 voting form. Bush, who's fluent in Spanish and whose wife was born in Mexico, later tweeted, "My mistake. Don't think I've fooled anyone." Oscar, do you think I have some sympathy? You know, he's perhaps going home feeling his... in an interesting way, that perhaps he is, you know, part of the Hispanic community. You know, he's married to a woman who speaks Spanish, who is Hispanic, and maybe how we feel about ourselves is beginning to evolve. You know, that you don't hang on to your white WASP background, whatever. You feel, actually, this is also my community.
This is going to help him, I'm sure. I lived in Texas for quite a while, and I saw George W. Bush campaigning, and Bush spoke much worse Spanish, if at all. And yet he managed to pass himself as someone who cared for the Hispanic community there. What this shows is how important the Latino vote is becoming in the United States, more and more as years go by. And actually, to make this mistake, inverted commas, might be the right thing to do.
Kathleen, what's your view on how Americans are beginning to see themselves? I do wonder whether the traditional barriers are breaking down. And actually, I think even here in the UK, when you ask people to tick on a census what category of person they belong to, I think people often hesitate. You know, they're coming from families which are often of mixed race. You know, do they describe, you know, they don't like describing themselves as mixed race. They feel part of their heritage is more important than the other. Their parents have divorced. You know, they cling to one side more than the other. It's very difficult, actually, what seems so simple, to sometimes describe what your culture is.
Yes, you tick other, I think, is what you do. Yes, I mean, America is quintessentially that. I mean, it's been 40 or 50 years since the California state ballot is in both English and Spanish. You just don't think anything about it. You celebrate everyone else's festivals along with your own. I don't think it's really a problem in terms of ethnic culture like that. I may be wrong, but my sense of it is that those sorts of distinctions are less important than some others we can think of. Socio-cultural socioeconomic distinctions, I think, are rather more important than whether you are native and Mexican and Californian, Utah and Britain or whatever, because it's just such a mess, the ethnicities trying to distinguish them in America. It's getting almost that bad here, of course.
Oscar, what's interesting when you look at the U.S., you know, it's still, of course, the case that many Hispanic communities, especially people who have come from Central America, from Guatemala, often seem to be in poorer jobs and having a tougher time in the U.S. But it is changing. You know, you turn on the TV, you go to the lawyers, you go to your bank. The people running those institutions are quite often from first, second generation immigrant families, many from Latin America. Do you feel that that is one of the success stories of the U.S.? You know, we see some setbacks in certain states, but that is one of the success stories of the U.S., that it still is adaptive and able to take on people from outside of the country.
Oh, I believe so. I argue that in a previous book of mine titled What If Latin America Ruled the World? And it will do so by proxy, in a sense, by becoming the majority in the United States. But make no mistake, race still matters in America. After Ferguson, it does matter. But it matters if you look at the way Jeb Bush tweeted his joke. On the one hand, look, I'm white. But then the secondary term was, but my son called me a honorary Latino. That's the way it works.
Thank you very much indeed. That was, of course, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Kathleen Burke. Thank you both very much for joining us here today on Midori House. And that's all we have time for today. Today's show, it was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Karen Harmagren. Sorry, I nearly murdered that name. And Mike Hune. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next hour, Daniel will be here to keep you company with Monocle's International Playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's Tom Edwards with our weekly design show, Section D. At 2200 hours, it's time for the Monocle Daily, another hour of news and comment. And this show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time to say goodbye. Have a good evening.